Welcome to the Speak Like a Leader podcast with John Bates.
Welcome to the show. With me today is someone I met, back in probably 2015 or something. And as you know, as you hear sometimes on this show, I got to meet this person through an introduction from a good friend of mine and somebody who just made an enormous difference for me in my life and continues to, Mike Michalowicz. So that's how we know each other, is that Mike Michalowicz connection. And who's joining us today is Dori Clark. And Dori Clark is someone that I've been watching since then. And she had a lot going on when I met her. I mean, like, I was already jealous of everything she had going on when I met her. And she has just continued over the years to just show up every day, do great content, do great stuff, make a difference for people. And I have just watched her go into the stratosphere. And so who's with me is Dori Clark, who's a best-selling author. She also teaches at Duke and Columbia. She's been named one of the top 50 business thinkers by Thinkers 50. And she's a leading global coach, a Marshall Goldsmith leading global coach in communications. So she's the leading communications coach, as named by Marshall Goldsmith. So you can see why I was, you know, so excited to have her join us here. And she's got a new book coming out in September. And this is kind of a cool time for a book to come out. It's coming out on 9/21/21. So September 21st, 2021. And so let me just tell you real quickly where you can find her, and then I'll actually let her get a word in edgewise. So her website is doriclark.com, doriclark.com. And if you want to get a cool self-assessment that I think she'll tell us more about, you can just go to doriclark.com/The Long Game. That's the name of the book, The Long Game, and I want to hear all about it. And if you want to follow her on LinkedIn, get great content all the time, it's doriclark.com/LI for LinkedIn. So D-O-R-I-E-C-L-A-R-K. Dori, welcome. Really great to have you here.
John Bates, really good to see you and to get to connect and catch up.
Thank you. Thank you. So you know, let's just jump right into the new book, The Long Game. You know, I mean, I can make up what that's about, and I think it's really good. And tell us what it's actually about.
Well, I it would actually be kind of fun for you to make up what it's about. Who knows? Maybe I'll get some good ideas.
Well, you know, what I will say, and I think it probably crosses over, is that when I'm working with executives and they're going through difficult times, especially, and like, you know, like, I mean, it's not always easy, right? And I keep reminding them, look, play the long game, you know, look back on the decisions you make today and be proud of yourself. Right? Play the long game. So am I in the ballpark?
I think you're totally in the ballpark. So the subtitle of the book is How to Be a Long-Term Thinker in a Short-Term World. And really what I am trying to encourage people to do, and hopefully in the book give them some tools to do, is to resist what feels like sometimes the constant push toward the short term that we face in our lives.
Oh my gosh. Well, I welcome that. And I think we need you obviously now more than ever. So I'm just going to say that self-assessment again, because doriclark.com, doriclark.com/The Long Game. So tell us a little bit more.
I would be glad to. So ultimately, when it comes to playing the long game, I mean, we know why, to a certain extent, it's hard to, right? Certainly, social media does not help, because you see this constant barrage of images, and it seems like everybody else has got it figured out. Everybody else seems to know what's happening. And meanwhile, we're living our lives, and we're pursuing whatever it is we want to pursue. And a few things rapidly become clear. The first is that everything takes a lot longer than we want it to.
Oh, I'm so tired of that.
I know, it's pretty annoying. But there's actually something kind of profound embedded in this, which is that, you know, we all know, we can certainly accept, everybody's been told by their mom and their grandma, you know, that there's no such thing as overnight success.
Yeah.
So we hear that and we nod and we say, yes, of course.
Yeah.
But the problem, John, is that nobody ever tells us what not overnight means. Does it mean two nights?
Yeah.
Does it mean a week? Or does it mean 10 years?
You know, Dory, I have a saying that I am very proud of because my brother was starting to do really well, you know, and he was kind of freaking out about it a little bit, which is interesting because that happens, right? But I said, dude, look, it's easy to be an overnight success when you've been doing something for 10 years.
Yep. That's
so,
that's
so I'm going with, you know, 10 years.
know? Yes, absolutely. And so anyway, in the moment, you know, if we don't really have a clear sense of like what it actually looks like, what it actually takes to get where we want to go.
Yeah.
In the moment, you feel like you're just kind of going through this tunnel and you don't know how long the tunnel's going to last. And in that moment, it becomes really impossible to tell the difference between is it not working or is it not working yet?
Yeah.
And if we don't know the answer, if we can't tell the difference between those things, that's the moment when it becomes really easy for people to give up quickly and to quit. And I think to quit too early. And for me, it makes me sad because I want the best people and the best ideas to win. I don't want them to just sort of fall off the track and never be heard of again.
Right.
And so I really wanted to try to help provide people with tools to be able to make better judgments about whether to continue pursuing things and how to move forward. Because if, you know, it's not to say you want to pursue every last idea, because not everything is worth it. But for the ones that truly are, if you are willing to go through the trenches where maybe there's not a lot of positive feedback, maybe there's not a lot of reaction at first, but if you suck it up and you're willing to do that, you can actually emerge on the other side with a massive distance between you and the competition.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly powerful, but we have to be willing to make that commitment and be persistent in that way.
Yeah. Well, that's fabulous. I mean, and you know, you bring up something for me, because I've always been an entrepreneur and I've raised several $100 million with my companies. But I've never had a successful exit in any of those, you know? So like there was always that thing of the difference between persistence that's good and then persistence that's like the dead flies at the bottom of the screen, right? In the long game, do you help people distinguish between that kind of a thing?
I definitely try to. And let me give you, John, a couple of tools that I think can be helpful to people in this process. So the first one is other people. Because the truth is, in the moment, we all become attached, and I would argue sometimes over-attached to our ideas. And it can go either way, right? Like on one hand, we might have so much of the sunk cost fallacy that we say, no, it has to work. I mean, just a little longer.
Yeah.
And, you know, meanwhile, you're giving it CPR and it's been dead for 48 hours, you know,
So been there, done that. You know?
That's right, brother. So you need some outside judgment. The other thing, of course, is that sometimes people tend to get despondent too quickly. No, it's not working. Oh, it'll never work.
Yeah.
And they quit. And so in advance, it is really important for all of us to assemble a group of people. This doesn't have to be a formal thing, but just in our minds, it's a question of who do you trust?
Yeah.
Who do you listen to? Who you really respect their judgment. They know, you know, that they have your best interests at heart, and you can go to them in those moments and just say like, hey, am I crazy? Like, what do you think here? And you want to have people you can turn to, because we just have to recognize we can't trust our own judgment in those times. That's number one. The second thing that I would encourage people to think about, and this is sort of a before we get too far down the road kind of situation. One of my favorite anecdotes from the book comes from Jeff Bezos, from his 2018 shareholder letter. And he tells a story about a friend of his who wanted to learn how to do handstands, like yoga handstands. And the friend hired a coach for this. You know, she was apparently very invested. Yeah. And the coach said, the average person thinks it takes about 2 weeks of practice to be able to do a good handstand. And the coach said, no, that is not right. It actually takes about 6 months of daily practice to be able to do an effective handstand. And if we actually peel that back for a minute, that is, you know, this is not like, oh, you overestimate or underestimate by 10%, 20%, you know, like this is not the margin of error. Yeah. It is a 12x difference in what is required. And for so many of us, we have that blind spot. We are massively overestimating, underestimating, we don't even know it. So doing the research up front is extremely powerful and I think can lead to avoiding a lot of heartbreak.
Yeah. Yeah. So quick little stories about both of those. I would just love to reinforce what you said, because I think that first piece, I remember when I was working in the internet industry in the early days, and I met this guy named Richard Hackenberg, and he worked at Chiat Day, and he called himself the old guy in new media. And it was hilarious. It was like, you know, 90s. And he really was the old guy in new media, because like he was the only guy with gray hair at any of the things that I went to, you know. And I remember thinking, by the way, he ends up now as one of my best friends, my friend, my mentor. But it's because I did what you said. I remember emailing him and saying, hey, would you just please have lunch with me? Could I please take you to lunch? And we sat down and we talked. And at the end of our conversation, I said, you know, I love my mom and dad, and my dad's a brilliant guy, but he's an attorney. He doesn't get at all what I do or the world I inhabit. Would you be willing to be my mentor? Could I just like run things by you once in a while? And he said, John, you know, I mean, he's such a great guy. He said, John, I think I'd probably get more out of that than you would, but I'd be happy to do it. And, he ended up becoming one of my best friends. You know, I hired my boss when I had big words. It was the best thing any of us ever did. And he's still a dear, dear friend helping me out in my life. And so I think that's a really good example of what I think you're saying there, right? It's not asking my mom, should I keep going? Because she doesn't know.
That's right.
It's asking somebody who's got a perspective on it, who has my best interests at heart, what they think, and then triangulating on a few of those people. And that has made an enormous difference for me in my life. So I heartily sign off on that.
I love that story, John. That's great. Fun fact, I never met Richard, unfortunately, but I was a Chiat Day intern when I was in college.
Oh, really? Were you at the binocular building?
No, I was in New York. So,
oh, you're in New York. Yeah, I was in LA. So yeah.
Yeah, but I know the binocular reel, and that was pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. So, well, that's awesome. Great organization. I mean, they're super successful. And then, you know, the other thing is, in the world that I inhabit with the TED-like talks that I do and all the people that I've coached for that kind of stuff, I know that when I went to TED, looking back on it, it seems silly, but when I went to TED, I remember watching those people and really in the back, I didn't really unpack it or examine it, but in the back of my mind, I had basically assumed that they were winging it, you know? Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, most people who give talks on that main TED stage, they practiced that talk for a year or more, you know, 6 months minimum. I mean, like, way longer than I ever thought. And then a good friend of mine who worked with Steve Jobs told me that he, after they would create those speeches, and a whole team would work with him, you know, he didn't just wing it by himself. He had a team and they really created these speeches and crafted them. And then once they were done, he would practice for an hour for every minute that he was going to be on stage. And guess who he stole that from? Winston Churchill.
My goodness.
So, you know, like the world really is different than I think I used to think it was.
Yeah.
And I think that those kinds of realizations, Dory, are just tremendously important. Like what you said, you know, oh, it's going to take me a few days to perfect my handstands. No, 6 months, you know, it's factors that we're off by if we just trust that, like, oh, yeah, I mean, no, let's dig into it and get the facts, right?
Yeah, that is exactly right. And yeah, it is amazing the level of preparation for TED Talks to really be able to perform at your best. And frankly, it's the exceptions that kind of prove the rule, because I mean, they pretty much mandate essentially that you have to, do this training, you have to, be all pumped and primed and have it memorized and all that.
Yep.
And, I was at TED a few years ago, and the big headliner who, apparently they must have made concessions for was Shonda Rhimes.
And I was there. I remember this.
That's right. That's
Nobody
right.
knows it that wasn't there though, Dory. Nobody mm-hmm. knows it that wasn't there because they edited it together, right? Go ahead and finish the story.
Absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, so she's like the one person that they let speak on a teleprompter. And of course, the teleprompter broke. And so she's
multiple mess ups.
I mean, it must have been like 4 or 5 minutes before they fixed it. I mean, that is an eternity when you are standing on a stage in front of 2,000 people. It was bonkers.
And not just any stage. You're on the TED stage in front of like Bill Gates and Oprah Winfrey and so-and-so and so-and-so. And all of a sudden, it becomes really obvious that you're using a teleprompter and the teleprompter is broken and you got to stand around and wait for it to get fixed. And I will say, to her credit, it was a fabulous speech, but there's a reason they don't let people use teleprompters. And there's a reason they say don't.
Which is that they always break.
Just doesn't work. Yeah, just doesn't work.
Yeah.
That's so funny. That was an amazing moment. I talk about that in my courses too, because I think it's good to know, because at the end of the day, you can go find that talk online and it looks perfect.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But in the moment, it was far from it.
Yeah. Well, it, goes to prove the value of the work you do, John, for sure.
Well, thank you, Dory. I appreciate that. So who's somebody that had a big influence on you? Who's a leader that you still remember some of their stories and they impact you?
Oh my goodness. Well, if we're thinking about, sort of like business leaders, business
anybody
mentors?
Could be your third grade teacher, could be a business, anybody who comes to mind for you.
Yeah. Well, I think that, there were college professors that really I thought were so incredibly interesting and engaging. And I was a humanities major. I was a philosophy major as an undergraduate. I was a theology graduate student. And so it was so exciting. I mean, my first career ambition for myself was to be a professor, because I just admired these folks so much. I admired what they did, just the way that they were able to dig into things with close readings and just show you things that you wouldn't necessarily know were there. You wouldn't know to look for them. But then once you saw it, you're like, oh, of course. Right. It's like kind of unlocking this world. So I think about a professor who's still there. I'm actually now on the board of Mary Baldwin University in Virginia, which is where I did my first 2 years of college. They had a early college entrance program that I was part of. And Dr. Edward Scott was a philosophy professor, and he taught, all this great stuff about, he was like a classicist. So he did, Plato and Aristotle and whatever. Uh-huh. And he was also, he was a black guy who was also an AME preacher, African Methodist Episcopal denomination. And his lectures were like almost like sermons. It was like a sermon about Plato. And it was just so transfixing.
That's
an amazing
awesome.
Communicator.
That's really, really cool. What's one of the things that blew your mind out of that course?
Oh my gosh.
Do you remember?
Some of what I really enjoyed. Years later, some of the things that I spend my time on now, I've gotten kind of serious about musical theater writing. So I do, write the book and lyrics for musicals. And I've been part of this training program and things like that.
Wow.
So
that's cool, Dory.
Thank you. Thank you. But so, at the end of the first year of this program that I was in, run by BMI, the music publishing company, we were required as like our capstone project for the first year to do a 10-minute musical on a subject of your choosing. And I managed to convince my collaborator. I'm like, I know what we should do. And she's like, what? And I'm like, Plato's Symposium.
I thought that was coming. That's cool.
That's right. So we did, yeah, we did this 10-minute musical about the symposium, which was fantastic. And the symposium, I mean, it's just, it's so interesting. Like I think a lot of people who don't study philosophy think of it as this like very dry technical subject somehow. And yeah. I mean, you know, certainly it can be, there are forms of it that are, but yeah. The Symposium is a book, which is basically, you know, a series of monologues that are captured where there's a dinner party and everybody at the dinner party in ancient Greece is required to give a speech about the meaning of love. And so each chapter is like a successive take on what is love. Like, I mean, that's a sexy topic. Like,
dude,
even today,
we should do a party
topic
like that. That's a freaking rad party.
Seriously, man. Yeah, a symposium party.
Yeah, that would be a great idea. I love that. Wow, that's cool. Blow my mind. Okay, that's a really good one. So you know, one of the things that I bump into a lot, and I think you must do, is people who think they don't have any good stories. You know, John, you ran away with the rock band and, you know, you went surfing through Indonesia for a year and you've got all these great stories. You know, I don't have anything like that. But what I would point out is that if you, as a human being, anywhere past like whatever, five, you know, there's so much stuff that's happened that I have forgotten that it's not even funny. So if I still remember it, and by extension, if you still remember it, that's a worthwhile story probably. Cause like it had some sort of an impact on you to the point that you still remember it, you know?
Yeah.
So what are some other, you know, how about this? You know, I always like to quote Les Brown, people don't connect with your successes. They connect with your messes. Your message is in your mess. Mm-hmm. What's one of those for you, Dory? What was a mess that really taught you like a hard, painful, important lesson? Can we go there?
Hey, sure. Well, I mean, you know, one thing I'll mention, John, which, you know, to your point, I actually used as the starting point for a TEDx talk that I gave.
Yeah.
In 2017, I gave a talk at TEDx. Lugano, Switzerland. And
so people can search Dory Clark TEDx Lugano, Lugano.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
exactly.
Find it. Okay, good.
Yeah. So it was a talk about, you know, sort of future proofing yourself. Uh-huh. And the starting point of this talk was me talking about basically when I came to realize I needed to be future proofed, which was, I had been a journalist not for very long. It was my first job after I finished graduate school. And I had been working at this paper for about a year. And I ended up one day getting called into the HR office and getting laid off. And
ouch.
Yeah, it sucked to get laid off from your first job. And what made it, I think, harder was this was early days. Like now it's like, well, duh, of course journalists get laid off. That's like the nature of journalism. But it was not the nature of journalism. We forget. But
yeah, at that point, it was not.
It was an extraordinarily lucrative industry. I got laid off in 2001. The year 2000 was literally the most profitable year in history for the journalism industry.
Wow.
It was rolling in money. And then all of a sudden.
And then whump.
Yeah. The spigot turned off because of Craigslist. Yeah. And advertising revenues plummeted. And so I got laid off. Now, this was kind of bad enough to get laid off from your first job. I was like, oh God, what am I going to do? You know, they gave me, I had worked Monday. It was like a Monday afternoon. So they were so nice. They gave me 4 days of severance pay. They paid me at the end of the week. They're like, here you go, kid.
Wow.
So I had to find a job very, very fast. The big problem was that it turned out that the day they laid me off was Monday, September 10th. 2001.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's kind of like the worst time ever to go job hunting.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, Dory, just I want to come back to your story, but I just want to commiserate with you. Not long after that, on October 20th, 2000, 7 days before my birthday, my company, where I was a co-founder, you know, three other guys, we raised over $80 million. October 20th, pulled the plug. You know, you're not going to be profitable fast enough, guys. We're just going to pull the plug. And I got tossed out on the street like everyone else. It was a rough time. That was a tough year. Okay. So there you are, 4 days of severance. Good luck, kid. The next day, September 11th. Tell me about the low point there. How did you feel? What were the thoughts that were going through your head? Like, go back to that actual moment and tell us for a minute, you know, like without the benefit of hindsight, how did you feel?
Well, immediately after getting laid off, I mean, I was mad and depressed and whatever. And, you know, I went out afterwards, later, you know, that evening of the 10th with this friend of mine who worked at the company. And we just sort of, you know, sat in the bar downstairs and had Mike's Hard Lemonade, which was, you know, was very cool to drink in 2001.
Yep.
And, you know, I was so frustrated, but I realized, like, okay, I really need to get a job. I need to find something. So I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll think about it tomorrow. And so the next day, I was actually in the morning. So, like, I try to be very responsible and very dutiful. And so I had actually promised to be a guest speaker on a panel the next morning about, I don't know, like religion in the media or something like that. And so I needed to get downtown for, like, you know, whatever, like a 10 a.m. panel that I was going to be on. And I saw that, you know, I had the TV on as I was getting ready and sort of having some breakfast. And I saw the thing with the plane, the first plane. And the first plane, everyone thought was an accident. Like, oh God, that's weird. That's, how crazy,
wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And then it was just starting to happen that the second plane had hit just as I was about to get ready and go and leave for this panel. And it seemed clear that things were weird and things were not right. But I was like, well, I have to get to this panel. I promised them I'd be on the panel.
Right.
And so I went down, my mom was in town. And so she wanted to come see me speak. So we, you know, took the train into the city and we get to where the panel was going to be, which was the Christian Science Complex in you know, like downtown, because, you know, it was a panel about religion. And the Christian Science Complex is right by Boston's skyscrapers, like right in the center of downtown. So as soon as we got there, I'm like, hi, I'm checking in for the panel. They're like, we're evacuated. I'm like, oh, geez. Okay. Yeah. So the good news, I guess, is it sort of distracted me from worrying about being laid off. But my mother had a hair appointment like that afternoon, like a few hours from then. And I'm like, Mom, things are getting weird. We should just go home. She's like, no. She's like, I don't want to miss my hair appointment. It's really hard to get an appointment with this guy. And I'm like, are you kidding? And she's like, no. Like, I have to wait for Charlie. So I'm like, okay. So we stay downtown. We like get some lunch. You know, as we're like walking, you know, to get lunch, there's literally like fighter jets flying overhead that have been deployed. I'm like, this is like really not good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have the lunch. Finally, we go to Faneuil Hall, which is where her hairdresser was going to be. Faneuil Hall has been completely evacuated.
Yeah.
Charlie's not there. No one's there. And it was just like, oh, this is really not good. Yeah. So I guess on the plus side, I was at least for that day not really thinking about my job, but I was very alarmed because I thought that not only would I not get a job, but that, like, you know, civilization might break down.
I mean, it felt like it. You know, I was in LA on a completely the other coast, but, you know, we were kind of waiting all day for, is this just going to roll across the country? Are they, you know, what's, I mean, you know, no one knew. It was a tremendously scary, uncertain time. So that seems to have really had an impact on you and how you think about, like, your personal brand. And I got to imagine that this had some impact on your book defining you, right? Like, this is one of your, this, so that experience of like being smacked by the future, right, if you will, and being laid off your first job really influenced your thinking. And in the end, I'd say that that was not only beneficial to you, but beneficial to everyone, right?
Yeah, thank you, John. And also, I just want to reserve the right to steal your title, Smacked by the Future. Sounds like a great book. You go, oh, I'd buy that. Yeah.
Right on, right on. Well, you know, let me do the foreword or something. You know,
I love it. I'll, yeah.
Collaborate even. But
team effort.
But yeah, Smacked by the Future. You know. You'll probably write it first.
That's so good. Yeah, I mean, it's true. Ultimately, after, you know, what I ended up doing was freelancing for a while as a writer and, you know, kind of cobbling together some not very glorious income from that. Mm-hmm. And eventually shifting to work in political campaigns because I did get an opportunity as a campaign press secretary, but, you know, I wanted to stay in journalism, but I just kept hearing, you know, I wanted to get hired by the Boston Globe and they're just like, we have a hiring freeze. And then they were like pinging me about, you know, they were creating some kind of like second class citizen deal. Like you could be a staff correspondent. And I'm like, what does it mean? And basically it's like, well, it just means we pay you a lot less.
Yeah, okay.
I
will just say, I think we're suffering through some of the problems of underfunding the fourth estate, you know.
big time, so, my man.
Yeah.
It's there was a valuable function that at one time was being served. That is for sure.
Kind of gone, yeah.
Yes.
But sorry, I interrupted you, but sorry.
No, not at all. But anyway, I did not immediately, I think this is true. There's a little bit of a hangover for everything, right? And so I did not immediately say, oh, well, I need to diversify my revenue streams. I need to de-risk myself.
You didn't immediately say that?
I'm just a little bit of a laggard in that way.
It makes me feel a lot better about myself, Dory.
But, you know, I mean, you kind of get stuck on something. I'm just like, I want a job in journalism. Like, that's what I wanted. Yeah. Like, why did this get ripped away? So, I tried to pursue these things. So, you know, I had these different jobs, but over time I came to realize, especially once I decided a few years after that, in 2006 to start my own business as an entrepreneur, that I really, just increasingly became aware of, especially because, you know, once you're an entrepreneur, it's like the scales fall from your eyes. You're like, oh, this is true of me now. But it has always been true. It has always been true that you have to make your own revenue. It has always been true that you can't count on anything, no matter, you know, what the promises are. It can be taken away any minute. It has always been true that we make our own safety. And once I really became aware of that, I was like, okay, I kind of became maniacal. And that's why I ended up writing a book in 2017 called Entrepreneurial You, which is about how to create multiple revenue streams in your business. That became a very explicit goal and an explicit strategy of mine to de-risk life as much as possible. Yes. And it actually, I mean, thank God, I think it was, it worked out and was beneficial. And I hope has been able to help other people, because what I realized was the things that you can do to de-risk predictable risks. And in my mind, the risks were like, well, it could be a recession. It could, you know, maybe I won't want to travel as much or whatever.
Right.
The things you do to de-risk predictable risks actually, not always, but oftentimes, and in this instance, can be the same things that overlap with helping you with unpredictable risks.
Yes.
So meaning during COVID, it was almost, you know, obviously it was a dramatically different situation on the ground, but the situation in effect was the same as if there had been a major recession, which is, all my speaking is canceled. Well, what do I do then? And so having multiple revenue streams was really the saving grace in that situation that thankfully enabled me actually to have my best year ever in 2020, which was kind of a surprise. Thank you.
Well, you know, and Dory, I miss, let's just say the title again. It's Entrepreneurial You.
Yes.
I said it wrong. you know, yeah, there's a woman that I think you would love. Her name is Fiona Merden. You can find her on Twitter, and she wrote a book called Defining You, and I just crossed wires there. But Entrepreneurial You, I think that's a great book for anybody, right? Because to just restate what you said, once you're an entrepreneur, you realize that the security of the job that seemed so secure, it's not secure at all, right? Like you're like, that's a false sense of security. And to take on that entrepreneurial side of yourself and do things to de-risk your whole life, that's a good idea, whether you're an entrepreneur or whether you've got a fabulous corporate job or whatever, right? So Entrepreneurial You is something that I think anybody and everybody should read versus, oh, that's for entrepreneurs. No, you might discover something about yourself that's really important, even if you're not an entrepreneur here, and some life strategies that could really make a difference no matter who you are. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, my man. It's true. I mean, as an entrepreneur, you are already de-risked a little bit because presumably, you know, if you're doing it right, you have more than one client. So that is helpful. It is actually, once entrepreneurs have gotten on that bandwagon, they usually understand like, oh yeah, diversification is really good. I should do more of that. But the big risk factor is people who have, steady day jobs. I mean, if you have one source of income, well, that's great. That's meeting 100% of your needs, but tomorrow it could go away and it's meeting 0% of your financial needs, which is what I discovered, working at my paper. I mean, it was a little bit of an extreme example because thank God most corporations are a little nicer and a little more generous and they probably will give you more than 4 days pay. But this is how it works in America. If they want to give you 4 days pay, that's what they do. And okay, sorry, we don't need you anymore. And that's just how it is. And so understanding that could be done to you at any time, I literally did not see it coming. I had no idea. I had no clue. And so, if you just ever want to protect yourself from being blindsided, one of the most important things that we can do, and it doesn't have to be dramatic or take a lot of time, but I really advocate for people in small ways to find ways to start experimenting. I mean, one example I tell in the book of Entrepreneurial You is about this guy, Pat Flynn, who is like you, a podcaster, a very successful podcaster. And the way he got his start, he was an architecture employee. He was like a junior kind of architect trainee. And he started out, he was taking the LEED certification exam for green buildings, which is a hard test. Yeah. And so he, as a study guide, started posting on a website, like kind of his study notes, and it became popular. And, other people were like, oh, this is good. They can benefit from it. And so the thought occurred to him. He's like, people can get it for free, like reading each web page and, click, click, click. But he's like, I wonder if anybody would buy this if I turned it into a book, like an actual book they could buy. And so he created it online. And in fact, so many people were interested. Within a few months, he was making more money from selling his book than he was at his day job. He was making about $4,000 a month at his day job. He was making about $7,000 from selling the books online. And as it happened, this is around 2008, architecture gets pounded because of, the real estate
2008.
Crisis.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. So he gets let go. And, he would have been in terrible shape. He had just, gotten engaged. He was, looking to buy a house, all these things. And it would have been devastating for him if he had not had this side gig he had been cultivating. But instead, he was able to say, well, maybe I'll spend a little more time exploring this. This seems to be going well. Yeah. And it created a whole new career path for him, which he continues to follow to this day.
Yeah. Wow. That's okay. That's a great story. And it points to something else. And I know we're kind of coming up on the end of our time, but it's something that you are a part of and have been a part of for quite a while that I think is starting to emerge into the more general consciousness, which is this whole creator economy. And that's a great story of what I mean by the creator economy. That guy just posted his notes and he did good notes and they were helpful to people. And now he's a part of what people are starting to call the creator economy. You do some online courses, and I think you do some things on LinkedIn. Will you tell us about a few of those things that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So as part of my quest to establish multiple revenue streams, I certainly try to walk the talk.
Yeah.
So I actually typically hover between like 9 and 10 different income streams.
Wow. I need to catch up with you there, Dory.
Thank you. Thank you, my man. I mean, they're all related. Like, that's the key. People might say like, oh my God, how do you have time for that? How can you have bandwidth? Yeah. But the issue is, it's not that like, oh, well, I'm a real estate investor and I'm a dog breeder and I, you know, whatever. Like, I am a professional skateboarder on the side. Like, no, those are really different things, but it's all about different facets of how to monetize your core expertise.
Yes.
So I mean, we'll see if I can, this is like a pop quiz. We'll see if I can tick them off.
Yeah.
But you know, so I do consulting for corporations. I do executive coaching for individuals. I write my books. I do business school teaching. I do online courses. I have a year-long mastermind that people can be part of. I do in-person, you know, like when there's not COVID, obviously, in-person workshops and trainings and things like that. I do sponsorships, like sponsored content and posts and things like that.
We're at 8 now.
We're at 8.
Yeah.
Did I mention my books? That's 9.
That was, you already mentioned your books.
Oh,
you
write.
Yeah.
Okay. I forget what the others are, but
it's still more than, you know, most. I think you're doing really well.
Yeah. Maybe one other way is I do to, you know, which they are kind of separate things is for my online courses, we can actually divide it up because I do online courses that I run and sell myself. And then I also have ones that I do where I'm paid by a company to create them. So
that's
sort of a distinction as well in terms of how it's run. So anyway, that's the basic idea. So somewhere between 8 and 10.
There you go.
So yeah.
So it's not that people have to go out and learn dog breeding and learn real estate investing and do like it. I like the distinction of multiple streams of income off of your core expertise, you know? And I think that that's something that someone in a corporate job, boy, I would recommend that you take what you know and start thinking about other ways to monetize that, you know, aren't going to go against the contract you signed with the company, but that would provide a bridge, right? I mean, I think that it's interesting because you really, you know, in this little span of time, we've thought about what happened in 2000. We've thought about what happened in 2008. We've all just gone through Corona. And, you know, I've got these little stickers I made for like people who helped me out through the pandemic. And it says in the same storm, but not in the same boat. And, I think it's been this has been kind of a culmination of all of these sorts of things and just really like jaw dropping, you know, and we have all, and still are in the same storm, but we're definitely not in the same boat. And if you've got these multiple streams of income and you've thought about diversifying yourself even a little bit, boy, that can just help. Because what we know for sure is this isn't the last thing like that that's going to happen. It's just the most
recent.
Yeah,
it would be nice if it were. But
yeah, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, so Dory, what else should I have asked you about? What's another thought, especially in that realm of communication and the value of communication and leadership? What's one more thing from the mind of Dory Clark for us that we could take away and think about and apply?
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, one element, John, that I often come back to when I teach this course at Duke in their executive ed program called Communication for Leaders. And it's interesting, you know, I've had now, I guess, a couple of iterations of it where I've done it virtually, which has never been done before, but we're back in December, we're going to go back to in-person, which is great.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I tell people in that course, which I think is really relevant to the work that you do, is there was a great study that was done a number of years ago by the Center for Talent Innovation, which is a think tank in New York.
Mm.
And they tried to get to the bottom, I think this is a valuable quest, of the phrase executive presence.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. Like
a lot to unpack there.
certainly is. You know, this is kind of the classic, like, well, I know it when I see it. Oh, you know, yeah. He has executive presence. Yeah. And like, okay, what are you talking about? Like, you know, because it is awfully unfair if there's a situation where this one purportedly has executive presence and that one doesn't. And then the person who doesn't is like, well, what do you mean? What can I work on? And they're like, well, right. I don't know.
Yeah.
So it becomes a kind of egalitarian quest to say, well, all right, what actually is this so that people can work on it? And what they discovered is that fundamentally executive presence, people are typically referring to three things. One, which is the smallest piece, which is good for a lot of us, is appearance. So about 10%, it typically refers to your appearance. You know, are you put together? Are you presentable? Right. Are you looking professional enough? The other two, I think, are especially interesting. So one of them was gravitas. And gravitas, the way they define it is basically, in a moment of crisis, are you somebody who stays calm under pressure? Mm. Are you the person who people kind of instinctively turn to? Like, well, what do we do now?
Yeah.
And if you can give people that sense, that often is kind of emotionally for people, that is the mark of a leader. But the third part, and this I think honestly is probably the thing that it is clearest that we can work on, is your communication skills, specifically your oral communication skills. Because if we think about anything with leadership, I mean, you know, for me, having worked in politics, I know, you know, how do we vet our leaders? Well, we do it through debates, we do it through town hall meetings, we do it through rallies. It's all oral communication. And so I like to advise my clients and my students in these executive ed programs that if you're going to invest in yourself, if you are going to really try to focus on, you know, what is the lowest hanging fruit? Like, where is the ROI for me?
Yeah.
Often the best choice is to invest in making you a better oral communicator, because it pays huge dividends in terms of how you are perceived as a leader.
Amen. Amen, Dory. Yeah. Clear. That, I mean, and, you know, I think that one of the things to just acknowledge is that isn't always necessarily logically the best, like how someone communicates. Like, they may have really great ideas and communicate poorly. But I always say, communicating with human beings, leading human beings, working with human beings, it's not logical. You might have noticed, right? It's biological. And that is how it is, you know? Now, should it be that way? Well, gosh, we could discuss should it be that way, but it's not going to change anything, you know? So I fully agree with you. So appearance, gravitas, and oral communication ability. Yeah.
That's right, my man.
Well, you know, we'd love to get your thoughts on this, because this is something that I was just thinking about. I'm reading Simon Sinek's Start With Why with my year-long leadership group. And, you know, I've always thought about charisma, which is tied to executive presence, I think, quite a bit. And so Simon had something that just added a piece to my musings about charisma. So let me tell you what I love as a definition. I'll tell you what Simon said, and then I'd love to have you just comment. Is that cool?
Sure.
So I was taught years ago that one definition for charisma is simply, it's as simple as this. What if charisma is simply being fully present with no ulterior motives? And that may not be everything, but that to me sounds like a fabulous place to start, right? Mm. That's a fabulous place to start. And then in his book, Start With Why, Simon says that charisma is just fundamentally driven by someone who is very clear about their why. Mm. And I think that if you bump those two together, and then you kind of pour that on executive presence, there's certainly something there. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, ultimately, you know, there's two facets to charisma, of course, right? There's the external definition of like, well, like, you know, what does it look like on the outside? Like, yeah. What's happening? And mm-hmm. I think the what's happening is if someone's charismatic, people are sort of inexorably drawn to them. And yeah. that is the evidence of it. But then yeah. the question is like, well, okay, what's happening on the inside for that person that is making that thing happen?
Yeah.
And I think for sure, people are drawn to a combination of a powerful vision and a sense of being seen or acknowledged.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you're not necessarily going to be drawn to someone. I mean, you know, maybe if you see them on TV and it's not in the context, but if you're dealing with a person one-on-one, you're not going to be that drawn to them if they seem like they couldn't care less about you, you know,
right.
like,
yeah.
like if they blow you off, you know, most people are going to be like, okay, whatever. Right.
Yeah.
So you want to have that element of both things. Like there's something that they're excited about. So you can get excited about it. And yeah. you feel, seen or appreciated, or there's some connection between yeah. you such that, you're not just a cog.
Yeah. Well, whatever it is, Dory, you've got charisma in spades, and I appreciate you sharing everything you shared with us today. Thank you very much. I know you're super busy, and I am super excited for you about The Long Game coming out on September 21st, 2021. And we'll make sure that this podcast drops right around then. And, you know, if you want to find Dory Clark and you joined us late, it's doryclark.com, doryclark.com/The Long Game. If you want to get a free self-assessment around that. And if you want to follow Dory and all of her great output, which is she's prolific to say the least, doryclark.com/LI for LinkedIn. You can follow her there. So Dory, thank you so, so much for joining me. I really appreciate you dropping all the wisdom bombs and sharing your stories and all that kind of stuff. And we'll have to get you to come back again sometime. And I do look forward to hopefully seeing you sometime in person again, once we're, you know, kind of through this or whatever. So all the best to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, John. Great to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining the Speak Like a Leader podcast. Go be awesome.